Hi, I'm Nino Ricci, the Alice Munro Chair in Creativity at Western University, and this is Who Do You Think You Are? Each episode, we talk to someone from the Western community who is making a difference in their field by challenging old assumptions or forging new models for how we make sense of the world. These are people who are showing us that creativity lies at the heart of innovation in any field, whether it be business or law or history or the sciences or the arts. They're also showing us how creative solutions often come from building bridges across the disciplines and breaking down the barriers that often blind us to new approaches. So I'm here with Jonathan D'Souza today, doctorate in music theory and history from the University of Chicago, a master's in music from the University of London, bachelor's in music from Western, clearly deeply steeped in music. Your book, Music at Hand, talks about the intersection between musical instruments and human bodies and how that affects the making of music. You're an associate member here at Western of the Brain and Mind Institute through your interest in, I guess, the neuroscience of music. You're coming at music from some pretty novel and, I think, cutting-edge perspectives. In the creativity course that I'm teaching this term here at Western, we talk about how creative people not only shift thinking in whatever domain they're working in, but actually create new domains of inquiry where none existed. To what extent do you feel that you're doing that and that you're taking the study of music into new territory?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't think I set out to do that initially. When I kind of started out with the project that eventually became that book, I didn't really know what I was doing. I knew there was something I was really curious about and really interested in. And then I was kind of reading around, you know, both within music theory, musicology, and cognitive science and philosophy, just kind of reading all kinds of things that seemed like it might make sense of it. And then kind of as I finished in graduate school, as the book started to come together, it seemed like other people were kind of converging on the same kind of thing. And so kind of at that stage when I was writing the book, I found myself like on a panel with some other people who were kind of thinking about musical instruments, technology, creativity, the body, all these kinds of same things, and kind of realizing like, oh, wait, there's a little niche emerging here. There's a little subfield emerging here. But it's not something I ever kind of could have predicted, right? It's just something that seemed to happen.
Uh-huh. So where did it come from? Where did these interests arise from initially?
For me, this interest in thinking about musical instruments as a kind of creative tool, as a kind of extension of our bodily ways of making music really comes from my own experiences as a musician, like through my whole life. Mm-hmm. So I started taking violin lessons when I was like 3 years old. And I basically can't remember a time when I didn't play a stringed instrument of some kind, right? My dad was a music teacher and a guitarist. So our house was just kind of full of musical instruments all the time. And I was very free to just kind of mess around, teach myself things on other instruments, play around with instruments a lot. At the point where I probably should have like picked one instrument and focused on that one thing and got really good at that. That was always the moment when I was like, oh, I think I'm going to learn how to play like concertina or some just like weird novelty thing. So for me, I kind of had this pleasure and this joy of exploring instruments and things since I was a kid. And that put me in a position when I found myself as a, you know, as a scholar and all this stuff to be able to write about that from a distinctive kind of perspective, because I have this hands-on experience playing different instruments, you know, I'm really kind of unpacking my own creative practice as a multi-instrumentalist in the book in a way.
What do you think that was about, this, you know, this wide-ranging? I mean, usually someone picks an instrument and they specialize in that instrument. What was it for you that kind of drew you to this sort of broader kind of musical experience?
I mean, part of it, I think, is there's a certain kind of fun in playing around with a new instrument and kind of figuring out what it does, figuring out what it can do. There's this kind of sense of surprise and the unexpected when you don't exactly know what's going to happen. And that experience, when you become very familiar with an instrument, that experience can kind of disappear a little bit. Actually, one of the chapters in my book is called Voluntary Self-Sabotage. Mm-hmm. And this is a phrase from a jazz guitarist named Kurt Rosenwinkel that I write about. And he tunes his guitar all weird to kind of give himself that beginner's experience again, uh-huh. to make things unfamiliar again, so that he feels it's kind of more interesting, more creative for him if he doesn't exactly know what's going to happen. Uh-huh. So I think I was partially that, you know, and partially, you know, you can do different things with different instruments. You know, you can experience music in different ways. You know, if you're playing an instrument that plays chords, you're kind of in the harmony and in a certain way. If you play the bass line, you're kind of in the music in a different way. Mm-hmm. If you, you know, and so on and so on. And so it kind of, it gives you different perspectives on the music and you kind of tune into different things. And I really enjoy that. I really enjoy that as well.
So is there a way of saying something different when you move from one instrument to another? Is it?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the different instruments, in a sense, have their own personalities, mm-hmm. right? So it's almost like you're kind of working with a different partner, right? Like if you were, you know, improvising with somebody else or, say, dancing with a partner, you know, you're, in a sense, responding to them, responding to what they want to do or what their preferences are. And what you get in, out of the interaction is something different than what you would get if it was just yourself or if it was just you and a different partner. And I feel a bit the same with musical instruments. You know, with a violin, for example, the pitches are kind of under my hand in a certain way, right? I can kind of go across the strings, I can go up and down, and it's a certain space where I can do certain things very easily, and then other things are actually very difficult. And so when I'm improvising on the violin, I kind of am kind of working with that partner to create mm-hmm. certain things, and it'll kind of encourage me to do certain things rather than others, right? And then, but if I'm playing, you know, some other instrument, that set of possibilities and constraints is going to be somewhat different.
So is that something that's, you know, built into the actual nature of the instrument, the way it's built, the way you hold it?
Yeah, I think those are, yeah, I definitely think that there are kind of tendencies built in, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that it ever, that the instrument ever completely controls what comes out or determines what comes out. But yeah, the way that you hold it, the way that it's tuned, the way that it's built, all of these are factors or elements. Now, you can do different things with that, and you'll see people who hold the instrument in a different way, or, you know, different traditions of playing things, right? Or, you know, these kinds of things, so that you get certain styles, right? If you're going to play in one kind of style or one kind of tradition, you might approach the instrument very differently and get very different things. But in a sense, that interaction with that tool does kind of set some of the parameters. You can't just play whatever you want on any instrument. There are kind of limits, right?
So can we compare that to language? I mean, you speak in French, you can say certain types of things in certain ways that you can't in English. It's the same.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's a really useful metaphor, right? To think about, like, idiom, right? There are certain things that translate very easily from one language to the other, mm-hmm. right? Just like there are certain musical things, you know, tunes or whatever, that are very easy to play on one instrument or the other, and it's not really anything distinctive about that instrument. There's nothing like that really sounds like it has to be on a trumpet or something. But then there are other kinds of gestures or other kinds of things that seem very distinctive, like with the trumpet, for example, right? That even if you play them somewhere else, it kind of sticks out and you kind of know, like, oh, that's kind of a trumpet thing, even if it's played on a piano or whatever. And those things are kind of idioms. Those are things that don't translate cleanly and retain some of their character or some of their personality a bit more. So yeah, I think it's a great example, a great metaphor.
But, you know, if we talk about music as language, there's a way in which it's very different from language.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's not semantically tied in the way language is.
Right.
It's kind of pre-literate, and yet it's so deeply affecting. What's going on there? What does it speak to so deeply?
Yeah.
Can you
talk
about that?
I think music does have a grammar. in a sense. There's definitely thinking in my field about this. People who are approaching musical grammar, drawing on cognitive linguistics and these kinds of these kinds of things. I mean, to go to the neuroscience for a second, there does seem to be evidence that if you kind of play a note that doesn't make sense in the middle of a melody, part of your brain that kind of deals with syntax will respond in a similar kind of way as if you're just speaking and you drop in a word that makes no sense. So there's a sense of we kind of seem to have a sense for the music that we know of a grammar, of a kind of syntax or way things should go together, right? And teaching that, you know, how those things go together is a lot of my teaching as a music theorist, teaching students how to, you know, what chord progressions are going to kind of sound normal or good together and which are going to sound kind of strange together. So I think that element is something kind of similar between music and language. But you're right. I mean, in terms of what music refers to, it doesn't kind of give us, you know, things, or it's not so much nouns in music. Music is this dynamic sound process that it can give us a sense of movement for sure. That's always going to be a bit more vague, right? And so something that sounds like, you know, a waterfall could just as easily sound like a roller coaster, could just as easily sound like something else. There's a sense of movement that we can attach imagery to, but it's always got this openness. You can get that ambiguity and openness in other art forms, I suppose, but it does seem to be something that music does well. And another thing, as I think music as this kind of in time dynamic art form also seems to have a very strong connection to the body and to bodily movement, to dance, or, you know, people tap their feet spontaneously or kind of sway with the music spontaneously. There's a sense that music has this direct connection to our bodies sometimes. And I think that's another thing that music is kind of doing for us.
So is there any kind of commonality in the visuals that people conjure up, or is it quite subjective and idiosyncratic? I mean, do they study these things?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. People definitely study these things. I mean, there are certain people who study this, who study the kinds of metaphors that get put onto different musical sounds or processes, and would kind of highlight the commonalities between. So if I said like a roller coaster and a waterfall, that has this sense of like downward movement, right? And we can kind of identify why we hear in some kind of general level a certain kind of movement in a piece of music. At the same time, there's other work going on right now. I know of Lisa Margulis is a scholar who's doing some of this. She gave a talk at Western about some of this work last fall, is actually doing work collecting people's narrative responses to pieces of music. And there do seem to be some kind of surprising commonalities in people's imagery that they associate with things. It's not clear whether some of that is mediated by, say, film soundtracks, right? People's associations or other things. And so she and her team, her collaborators, are looking at this cross-culturally as well, to try to tease apart the different kind of factors there. So that's very, a lot of it is very surprising work, and it's still kind of ongoing. So I don't really know what's going to come out of that project. But this is definitely the kind of thing that certain music theorists are curious about.
Now, we tend to think of music as kind of a high art, but its roots are deep and primal.
I mean, I think it was serving a lot of different functions, and I think probably most of those functions are it's still serving today, right? To bring together social groups, perhaps to function in a kind of spiritual practice, right? To coordinate people who are working together just for fun, you know, these kinds of things, to soothe babies to sleep, for example, or to pump yourself up. You know, I think probably all of these uses of music that we use today were all happening at that, you know, in that prehistoric time. And even, I mean, somewhat maybe surprisingly, but people were playing musical instruments, you know, purpose-built things. I've written a little bit about these bone flutes, thousands and thousands of years old. These are from a time when Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons were still coexisting, and they're these very delicate, fine bone flutes that were made. This is, you know, long before the invention of the wheel, long before the invention of writing. You know, I always think when you get a kind of a standard kind of cartoon thing to have like the the caveman with the like stone wheel or something, but like they should actually all be like playing flutes and drums, because that's a much older human technology.
Or listening to the stones.
Yeah, exactly.
We tend to think of music as, you know, high and low, with, you know, high music being the good stuff.
Yeah,
and low music being the bad stuff. I mean, is that a meaningful distinction? Is Beethoven better for us than the Rolling Stones? Or is that kind of an arbitrary distinction we've made?
I mean, those distinctions are so tied up with all kinds of cultural politics, with power, prestige, money, all these kinds of things. And so the values that have been ascribed to different kinds of music, I mean, this has a long, long history, and there's lots of people in musicology and ethnomusicology and so on who have done really important work on these, how these things kind of get put together. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the Stones. One of my, you know, one of my old professors from my master's, you can point out that, you know, there's a lot more, say, scholarship about the Beatles than there ever is about the Rolling Stones, because the Beatles kind of tapped into that, some of that kind of high art aesthetic and cachet in some of the stuff that they were doing in a way that the Rolling Stones did not. Some people find that more interesting, but does that make them better? I don't think so.
So is Beethoven doing the same thing for us as Mick Jagger, or is it?
I mean, I think there's probably a lot. I think probably Beethoven and Mick Jagger have a lot more in common than most people would think, right? I mean, Beethoven was known in his day as a kind of wild man, as a great improviser and kind of a fiery performer, as someone who would kind of mess with his audiences a little bit sometimes, who was kind of like a little bit rude to the people who he should have been polite to sometimes, and so on. So, I mean, there maybe are parallels there, although I wouldn't want to ever like push that too far. I mean, I guess the way I would think about it is that somebody like Beethoven or somebody like Mick Jagger or whoever we want to talk about, these musicians are emerging in a very complicated and rich kind of network or kind of situation, right? Mm-hmm. So that there are always these kind of rich relationships between the musicians and audiences and other musicians and, you know, musical technologies, all of these things combine for us to think about kind of what's kind of musically possible at any different moment, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of how the music is going to be produced, how it's going to be shared, what kinds of things people are looking for from music in that time and in that place. You know, that changes from moment to moment, or even for the same musician from context to context. You know, in a way, I'm kind of interested in the world around Beethoven, you know, the world of people and things that he's kind of interacting with that make him, that kind of are the background to for around him or for understanding what he's up to, if that makes sense.
So is there a way of saying, you know, they needed Beethoven the way we needed Mick Jagger or the Beatles, that music responds to something needed in the cultural environment?
On some level, right, any musician that makes it really big like that obviously is tapping into something in the culture, something that audiences are interested in. That involves aspects of their music, the way the music is put together. It involves aspects of their persona that people are drawn to. It may involve other things as well, right? Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't other great musicians that kind of never make it or never become that famous. But I think for anybody to become a kind of iconic musician like that, I think, it probably is fair to say that some aspect of their work, right, really kind of connects with something that's going on. It may be that they're kind of actively shaping themselves to market themselves that way, or it might just be coincidence. There could be a million different reasons why. But certainly, you know, a figure like Beethoven, there's been a kind of a lot of cultural work to kind of position him as this great, as this, you know, the great musician. But I think people have also kind of taken different things from him at different times. Mm-hmm. So actually, an example of this, I was just chatting with a colleague recently about Mozart and different attitudes toward Mozart. There's a kind of one stream of thinking that just understands Mozart as this genius who just effortlessly could just produce music out of thin air, and this was his, what marked his gift. And what my colleague was saying, if I remember correctly, was this is kind of a later story or picture of Mozart that earlier on and closer to his lifetime, people valued that he was kind of a hardworking, you know, this is a kind of Protestant work ethic narrative, right? That he was a hardworking musician and a kind of a good guy and, a, you know, support his family and all these kind of values were projected onto Mozart at that point, right?
How does the myth come about and why does it come about?
It often comes about through the active work of critics and historians, journalists, you know, these kinds of people who tell the stories that go around the musicians. Sometimes the musicians tell the stories themselves. Sometimes the musicians' stories are not true at all, but they're very effective. So whenever we find popular music like this, not to just mean like popular, you know, like pop and rock and whatever, but music that kind of has some kind of resonance with people, there's always kind of talk around it, right? There's always stories that go with the music as well. And that's part of shaping the myth. And in some ways, I mean, maybe kind of classic, you know, one way to understand what makes classic music, and again, not just classical music, but any kind of music that remains popular for a long time, is maybe part of what is going on there is the music kind of has enough different stuff in it that it can appeal to different cultural values or different interests at different times, or it can appeal to different groups, different kinds of listeners at the same time as well, right? That has got this multiple perspectives built into it in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, the Mozart example is interesting because I think in some ways Shakespeare would kind of fit that too. I mean, he was the working playwright in his day, and he churned it out, two plays a year.
Right.
But, you know, about 10 years after he died, then the myth starts to get formed in a very similar kind of way.
Right.
In literature, at least for me, it's easier to understand how that extra layer gets understood because, you know, there's a semantic level that's clear. You can say, well, he talked about X and Y, and you can see these embedded themes. You know, music has a level of abstraction to it that makes it harder to talk about in those terms. So what, you know, what is it that music is doing for us? What makes it last? What makes a piece of music the one that, you know, we're still listening to 200 years later? Is that a question that you can answer?
I mean, I probably can't answer it, but it's also the kind of question that's so fascinating that I also can't not try to answer it. Like, I kind of, this is exactly the kind of thing that you keep going in circles with because it's so rich, right? Music can feel both very abstract and very immediate and very intimate. And I think this paradox is part of what gives music a certain kind of power in various situations. We can feel very interior. I feel like our emotions, our feelings are just like there in the sound. But at the same time, the music can make us move our bodies, or the music can be this exterior thing as well, partially because of that vagueness that I talked about, which is kind of related to this abstract but also very sensuous and very immediate aspect of it, is it leaves room for us to kind of put ourselves into it in a lot of different ways. I mean, not that we don't put ourselves into stories or into artworks and other ways, of course we do, but it's kind of, music is quite generous in a way to open this space for us to go in and imagine certain kind of movement experiences, emotional experiences, interpersonal experiences, or narratives, or you know, all these kinds of things. The question of, you know, what exactly makes a piece stick around, you know, I mean, it's very tough for me to say. I mean, I can imagine, you know, there's like a kind of two extreme positions that I think are both kind of partially right and mostly wrong, right? We could say that it's basically nothing to do with the music itself, which is a phrase that people in my field, we try to be very careful about talking about the music itself as though it's totally separate from the world around it. But, you know, you could say like, oh, well, it's just the myth making, it's just the political and historical things. But you also can't just say it's something just totally inherent and this is what makes it great is the internal relationships. I mean, again, there's a history of people in my field who thought that way, but kind of also don't really believe that anymore, most of us, right? It's, the truth is somewhere in between, that there are these, a variety of factors that you can't predict. And also these things can go in and out of fashion, right? So there are certain things that, you know, we think of as, oh, these great classical music things, but they weren't necessarily popular the whole time. When they were written 100 hundreds of years ago, they might have actually started out very unpopular. Bach is kind of held up as the, you know, greatest composer by many people. But in his time, he was kind of seen, a lot of people kind of thought he was kind of an old-fashioned, not the most famous or important musician of his time. So it's this kind of weird thing. You can never predict what is going to happen with the, I mean, if you could probably make a lot of money, right? To explain why a certain song is a hit and another mm-hmm. song by the same artist is not, it seems impossible to me.
So there might be elements of Bach that, you know, didn't speak to a certain era because they didn't need him, but then he speaks anew. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah,
like
people
that?
Kind of latch on to different things, right? I mean, another aspect of this whole thing is the way that any one musician's work or any one kind of music relates to a kind of stylistic world that comes around it. There are certain things that any musician does that might be very creative and very unusual, or a little bit unusual maybe. But if you don't have a sense of their kind of musical world that they're coming from, it's hard to pick out like what are the new novel things there and what are the kind of standard normal things mm-hmm. there. I mean, I've been thinking about this and I don't know how you define creativity or people use this word and for ages I've been thinking like, I'm not sure if I know what creativity means, uh-huh. right? So I'd be interested to see what you or other people think about this. But within a musical context, if something is completely standard, completely predictable, doesn't deviate at all from the kind of what's the kind of normal thing, that doesn't seem creative. If something is completely random and you can't make any sense of it, that doesn't really seem right either. And what you're looking for is that sweet spot in the middle, right? As a music theorist, thinking about the kind of rules of a particular style, unless I have those kind of rules for the norms, I can't pick out the special thing, you know? I used to work with a singer-songwriter in playing fiddle and mandolin and stuff, backing him up. And he would kind of have one hook chord per song, usually, like one kind of interesting harmonic move mm-hmm. in a song. And the rest would kind of be a standard and his clever lyrics. And that was enough to make some pretty great songs.
There are theoreticians out there who would say, you know, something might be creative in a certain era because it's needed or it seems to say something new in that context, and a generation later no longer has that usefulness.
Right.
But 300 years later may suddenly come back. You know, someone like, you know, John Donne is a poet who
right.
who was revived in
right.
the 20th century because people started discovering new things in him that they hadn't
right.
noticed before that seemed useful at the time,
right.
whereas
right.
some people just seem to last regardless.
Right, yeah. And that also, you know, that also depends even within one time on the reader or on the listener, mm-hmm. right? As part of my studies in music, I've listened to a lot of different kinds of music. But part of that is listening to very kind of strange avant-garde things that sound kind of like noise to a lot of people. I've kind of ruined my ears in a sense. Like I've listened to all this weird music. It just sounds like music to me now. But I also know that kind of out there stuff is in that sweet spot of creativity for me as a listener, because I kind of have the right kind of experience to make sense
right.
of it. But I also know that I'm not going to play like that when I'm like doing a St. Patrick's Day gig at an Irish pub, because I kind of have to match my audience and meet them in the right place, right?
Are they, however, doing something that, you know, is introducing a new element that 20 years from now will be readable by a large enough number of people to make it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a question. I'm thinking of certain kinds of, say, like early 20th century modernist mm-hmm. music. And some of them definitely thought that, like, oh, in 50 years, people will be whistling these tunes. And it kind of hasn't happened.
Uh-huh.
It's an interesting thing that music still sounds very unpleasant to, I think, most listeners. Whereas abstract art is mm-hmm. kind of like on the wall in the McDonald's and nobody really cares. So it's a weird thing or an interesting thing that modernist music is still, even though it's like a lot of it's like, you know, it's over 100 years old.
Yeah.
But students coming in still kind of have a negative response. It still feels too new, even though it's definitely not. And part of that is related, again, to the musical characteristics and the kind of question of musical grammar, where it takes a lot and you're not really going to be able to internalize the grammar and have a sense of what comes next, because the music is kind of actively suppressing that. And I think for something to become part of our musical vernacular, or something that we just, you know, listen to and can hum along with and so on, there does need to be some more predictability so that you can kind of latch on to the patterns in a different mm-hmm. in a different way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still find that music interesting, but it's a doing a different kind of thing. We could maybe understand it, since I've been talking about all these different things that music does, this is a kind of music that pushes the thinking and the pattern as far as it can, mm-hmm. right? Just like other music might push danceability as the main thing that it's interested in and kind of strip away other aspects of the music, because that's what it's kind of all about. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just kind of taking that in an interesting direction.
So can we talk about what it is that music does for us? Why do we care so much about it? It's odd in a way.
Yeah, no. It is odd. I mean, you know, and it's a thing, you know, some kind of music exists in every human culture. Uh-huh. So, I mean, there are a lot of very substantial differences from one musical culture to the next in what they do. But there's something that we would think of as music just everywhere. So it does seem to be this kind of like language, a kind of fundamental human thing. I mean, for me, I do think it kind of all comes back to embodiment, to the body, to movement and connection and emotion and these kinds of things. I think a lot of it is fundamentally about that music can connect us with each other and connect us with ourselves somehow. You know, it's something that's produced by our bodies and something that is kind of taken up by our senses and our sense of hearing, but also of our sense of movement and these kind of other things as well.
So do we talk about it being somehow good for us, or is that not a valid question? Is it?
So I'm kind of cautious about saying like that some kinds of music are, say, you know, morally better or something than others. You know, I don't believe that say playing Mozart is going to make your baby smarter or something like that. But I think there are, at the same time, often kind of general benefits associated with music. I mean, the whole field of music therapy shows how music can be used in all kinds of ways to, you know, therapeutically to help all people with different kinds of situations.
Is there a danger? I mean, given how deeply it affects us in a way we're barely...
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think that's true, too. And I think that's always the flip side with this kind of thing, right, is music then can be used in propaganda or for emotional manipulation as much as, you know, these other things. You know, if music, you know, like I say, music is seems to be useful for social bonding. That doesn't necessarily mean, like, that doesn't predict what that social group is going to do, you know, or, uh-huh. or whether that's a good thing or not. Music can definitely be used in very negative ways as well. There's some very interesting research on music as torture, which is something that's being used, has been used for the last number of years.
Like really bad music or?
No, it's not that it's bad music per se. It's just a culturally aversive music. If somebody plays you music that you don't like, uh-huh. very loud volumes unceasingly, you mm-hmm. know, 24 hours a day, it disrupts your sleep, it makes you feel a certain way. And this is stuff that has been done. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is done. You know, it's often, you know, things like heavy metal or so on played for prisoners from, you know, non-Western countries where they're not familiar with that music. And it's a kind of torture that's, you know, psychological torture, right? It doesn't leave any marks that are detectable mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. so on, but it can really have a very negative effect on those people. And it is used as a kind of weapon, right? Mm-hmm. So which is it's a really horrible thing from my perspective. This is not to say that there's anything even inherently aggressive about heavy metal, because they've done, you know, these studies for heavy metal fans, the intensity of that music can actually be very calming and very and increase a positive feeling, right? Uh-huh. So again, a lot of this is about the kind of fit between the music and the listeners and a kind of relationship there, rather than anything like completely inherent in the music itself. Not to say the music doesn't matter, but I think the relationship is often more important than we think it is.
Now, you talk a lot about in your work, the relationship between the body and the actual instrument and how that informs the experience. Are we at a new moment now in that it's so much easier now to synthesize music, to synthesize the instruments, to create more generic forms of music, to have computers generate the music? Is that going to change our relationship to music?
Yeah, I think it has. It has to have some kind of effect or effects, and figuring out exactly what those are is a fascinating thing. With my perspective on musical instruments, I kind of feel like music has always been technological on some level. It's always involved these tools and those kinds of dynamics. So it's not a question of like technology just coming in and changing things. It's a sense of these new technologies offer different things than the old technologies. And so we try to have to figure out what is similar there and what is different. I think obviously a big part of what's different about music in, say, the 21st century is that, right, it's become this, you know, these files, these kind of seemingly immaterial things that are on our devices or streams just coming kind of magically through the internet. And so our access to music has exploded in all kinds of different ways. This was already happening in the 20th century with recording technology, but I think it's kind of accelerated that maybe, you know, and access in different ways. Partially, I can have music wherever I go, like on my phone in my pocket. I have hours and hours of music, which I could never do that before, or even if I did have a Walkman, I only had like a tape or two, you know, I didn't have access to these things. I remember, you know, and I'm probably maybe one of the last music scholars to have this experience in some ways. I don't know that my students have this experience. As an undergrad, remember reading about music that I couldn't hear, that I couldn't get, right? I remember reading these kind of effusive descriptions of certain things, and I called into the campus radio station here for one show and said, do you have any of this musician? Could you play something? Because I've read that it's so great, but I don't know. And, you know, my friend who was running the show said, no, we don't have anything like that in our library. And that was that. I didn't hear it for years later. Now, with things like Spotify, things like YouTube, now you can't find absolutely everything, but most of those things are just one quick search away. Uh-huh. You know, with any musician, there's kind of a musical world, and how their music fits into that world kind of determines whether it's kind of normal, whether it's kind of weird, whether it's kind of in the middle. The music that we have access to is just so enormous at this point that it's kind of changing the whole, potentially, for people who are interested in kind of listening to different things. There's just this enormous, potentially overwhelming number of things that you could listen to. People are also now kind of have access to background music in a way that was kind of difficult in earlier times when the music had to be made by someone there, right? And, you know, that might have positive effects. It's certainly, you know, if you're exercising or something, you can kind of regulate your mood using music in ways that are amazing. At the same time, some people worry about, you know, that we don't pay attention to music directly enough because it's kind of always on the background. I'm not so worried about that. I think there are some music there where I want to like pay attention to it and listen to it. And there's other music where I like to have it on in the background while I work, and it can. And then there's some music that can kind of go either way, and that's great.
Just at, you know, at a purely technical level, when I'm listening to something that's digitized, am I hearing something different than an analog recording, for instance, or a live performance?
Yeah, there are differences with this kind of thing. You know, MP3s, for example, are processed in a way to take a lot of information out of the file to make the file smaller. And if you know what to listen for in terms of the artifacts, you can tell, you know, you can tell the difference in sound quality, in depth, and these kinds of things, you know, and digital sound, you know, digital things sometimes have a different sound. People talk about the warmth of vinyl or these kinds of things. I mean, I think there are kind of always two sides to these things. I think sometimes people romanticize the analog technology a little, you know, because it's nostalgic. I mean, I love records. I mean, I remember, you know, this age. I'm very fond of that. again, there are also these kind of advances, things like noise-canceling headphones are amazing. There are certain things you can hear in these really quality headphones that we have now. That also offers a kind of listening experience that's kind of incredible and kind of great thing. The technology isn't neutral. It's going to offer us cool things, and it's also going to always have drawbacks. And kind of trying to figure out what that is
there
pretty
a,
tricky.
I mean, my stepdaughter does music for film and TV. Often it's much too expensive to actually go out and record
it. Of course, yeah.
But you can create, you know, what sounds like a violin, what sounds like a piano.
Yeah, definitely.
And yet nobody's playing the violin or the piano. So does that...
Right.
What does that mean, given that the work that you've done is really kind of looking at that interaction between instrument and the human body? If you take that out, does it make something different?
Well, I mean, I think that kind of work, when it's done really well and you can't tell the difference between the fake version and the real one, I've written a little bit about this, it usually plays with the idioms of the instrument or kind of keeps that in mind so that, you know, you can take a violin sound and play something that would never be possible on a violin. That will usually not really sound like a violin. But if you take the violin sound and you play something that would sit very well on a real violin, then people are much less likely to notice the difference. At the same time, I kind of argue that there's something interesting that happens with like fake violin sounds or fake trumpet sounds where you know it's not the real thing, but you also understand that it's referencing something. And so there's a little bit of irony or a little bit of extra meaning that comes from that. So one of the examples I talk about is Stevie Wonder's use of the fake strings on Songs in the Key of Life. There are moments there where, like on Pastime Paradise or Village Ghetto Land, where he kind of has this kind of fake string orchestra kind of classical-ish sound underneath. And part of the meaning of that, something like Village Ghetto Land, is the lyrics are painting this dystopian scene which jars against this kind of super sweet music. But in recent years, he's been touring with a real string orchestra. And the real string orchestra isn't as good as the synth one, because when you have the synth one, you have that kind of uncanny like violins that are kind of like a little robotic, a little creepy. And that adds another layer of meaning. So I think the synthesizers are so interesting in that even when they imitate imperfectly, there's a kind of richness there. But yeah, in terms of you know, how this changes things, for sure it's a concern for a lot of musicians, and since synthesizers started to emerge, a concern that this is putting people out of work. And you know, it has for it in film and television, in you know, pit orchestras for theater and things. You can kind of fill out the sound artificially in all these ways. At the same time, it seems kind of so that's a real thing and has real consequences for people's careers and stuff. But at the same time, I also think it's kind of amazing and potentially wonderful that one musician can do all these things, that the technology makes it possible for you to create this richer sound world that you might not have been able to create on your own before. And it also opens up this creation to people who maybe don't have the technical skills or the bodily abilities to do certain things, that you can write a piano part and have the computer play it for you. And you can kind of create piano music, even if, you know, say you're not able to play the piano for whatever reason. So it potentially also opens up access or you know, things in interesting ways, which could be a great thing. But the other side of it is, yeah, now there's not that kind of studio orchestra recording the background for the show or whatever.
I mean, you came into all this through your own relationship to music and the performance of music.
Yeah.
So where are you with that now? What is music for you? Does thinking about it this way reduce it in some way, or does it make it richer? And
yeah, I mean, this is always, I think, a common criticism or fear that people have around music theory, that if you learn a lot of music theory, it's like learning how the magic trick works, and then it's kind of not impressive anymore. But that's not how I feel, right? I mean, the more I learn and the more I study and the more I practice, the more things I seem to notice and enjoy and get out of music, you know? So I'm kind of not worried that like I'm going to kind of solve music by theorizing about it. Like music is so much more rich that I'm never going to have to worry about that problem. So yeah, I mean, it goes through different stages for me. There have been times in my life where I'm kind of actively composing and writing music. There have been times when I really am just primarily focused on writing about music. And then there are periods when I have been playing a lot, either, gigging a lot or just practicing a lot. And, you know, right now, I mean, when I lived in Chicago, I was in a couple bands and I was playing a lot. And I kind of had wonderful musical partners that I made music with regularly. And since coming and teaching at Western, I don't so much have that. I don't have a kind of regular band that I'm in. But over the last couple of years, yeah, I mean, I play music. I practice, you know, I practice kind of a lot. And mostly what I'm practicing these days and working on is improvisation, you know, is a thing that's really satisfying for me to do. Trying to shape something, to make some new music in the moment that tells a story or makes sense. Trying to incorporate new kinds of ideas and just kind of see what happens in a situation that's never fully predictable. That to me is something that's fun. It's exciting. It's kind of engaging on like a lot of different levels. Mm-hmm. So that's mostly what I practice is improvising in with various instruments. I kind of work on that a lot.
Well, I'm glad to hear that music has remained a vibrant part of your life despite the amount of analytical work you've had to bring to it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's been a real pleasure. I'm Nino Ricci, and this has been Who Do You Think You Are? A Western University podcast.